Defoe may have the showier role, but it is the beautifully brooding Pattinson eerily channeling a young mustachioed Robert Mitchum, who has the tricky task of steering this two-hander into a full-blown psychological tempest. That is a review from Justin Chang. He's a beauty. Writes for the LA Times. The Lighthouse, one of the films that we're reviewing this time here on Cinephile. Thanks, as always, for checking us out. Please do subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. That is how we keep things rolling here. Special guests today, including James Andrew Miller, the author of many acclaimed books, including the ones about Saturday Night Live, ESPN, and also CAA. So Jim's going to join us to talk about some more meaningful films, at least of his lifetime, and I'll also give mine as well. And also, I don't know how we got him, but my dad is available as well. He's going to talk about an excellent new documentary, which is available on Netflix. Let's talk first, though, about The Lighthouse, because it is really a movie that I was highly anticipating, played at the Cannes Film Festival. It's shot in gorgeous black and white, and you've got this story, which is about as straightforward as it gets. It's just two guys losing their minds in a lighthouse, set in 19th century. It's actually shot in Nova Scotia, but I mean, the visuals of it, you feel like you're watching a silent film, and clearly owes a lot to German expressionism and, you know, films of that era. Even as Chang writes in his review, The Lighthouse may be a little too in love with its own virtuosity, but who can blame it? At a time when American movies are overrun with shopworn visions, its madness is a bomb and a beacon. Robert Pattinson plays a guy who shows up, and Willem Dafoe is the lighthouse keeper, and then very quickly treats him as a slave, treats Pattinson with, you know, he denigrates him and tells him what to do and clean this and clean that and carry this and carry that. And then at night, the two guys have a few drinks and tell some stories. And Defoe's character is the one who's much more verbose, you know, laughing and cackling. And his accent, I mean, at first it sounds like he's impersonating a pirate. It does take a little bit of getting used to it. Twas he. Look at the Blarney Stone. But Defoe is such a good actor. If at first it seems a little bit of a character or a cartoonist, later on he shows that this guy's got a real twinkle in his eye and is not to be trifled with, even as he is an issue with flatulence, which makes him, again, look a little bit cartoonish. As for Pattinson, his character is much more intense and straightforward, but he gets more and more angry because of the fact that Defoe's character is getting under his skin, and he's just trying for release. I mean, there's a scene of the guy, I could have done without the scene of him furiously masturbating, but he has these crazy visions. He's got mermaids taunting him. He's got ideas that Defoe's trying to kill him. So, as I said, really, this is a story about madness. It is about two men in one location who, driven by circumstances beyond their control, the weather outside, the fact that they can't leave, the fact that their jobs are the way this is, that the fact that they're limited to each other, almost chained to each other, eventually things start to unravel. And then Pattinson's character has to tell a very big revelation, and then Defoe's character reacts, and away we go. At times, it feels like it's a dream. It's very surreal, but it is beautifully shot. I mean, just gorgeous black and white in 2019 to see a film that's actually in a major theater at an AMC Garden Plaza where I was. I couldn't believe I'm actually watching a black and white film. But of course, you got two major stars, and Defoe is somebody who critics love, and Robert Pattinson's a huge name as far as people who love box office draws. I mean, for God's sakes, the guy was in Twilight, and now he chose to make this movie. So respect to him for doing it. Robert Eggers is the director, also made a previous film called The Witch. He's obviously a very stylish director. Having said all of that, Joe, I'm only going to give it 2.5 Maple Leafs because the plot is about as malnourished as Pattinson's character. I mean, it's literally just two guys hanging out, and at times I thought the story could have used a little more oomph, couple of twists and turns, and even the dialogue at times, a little bit tough to follow. Again, I give Eggers credit because he's writing in like that 19th century prose and that dialogue, which can be tough to follow at times. But ultimately, I recommend it for the style, the vision, and for the acting. Are you going to be seeing The Lighthouse? I give it 2.5 Maple Leafs.
I will be seeing The Lighthouse. I did really love The Witch, and it doesn't surprise me that he wrote in the same prose of that era, because he does that in The Witch too, and I've been reading reviews that he that this movie might be a little bit more demented than The Witch, but it sounds like from what you're telling me, it was just kind of underwhelming at parts.
Yeah, I mean, you do have demented seagulls, a mermaid, octopus tendons, and the beacon of light, which is key to hear, you know, these guys all losing their minds. But yeah, it is certainly an unsettling film set in 1890s New England. But if you want something different right now at the multiplexes, that's the one that I recommend for all of you. Some entertainment news before we get to Jim. This will be Robert Evans. That's right. The Paramount executive produced Chinatown, Urban Cowboy, Life as Melodramatic and Jaw-Dropping as Any, passing away Saturday night, 89 years of age. Of course, you should go back and watch Chinatown, which I just recorded again on TV. So I think I'd like to watch that again. Marathon Man, Urban Cowboy. Also, of course, he was heavily involved with The Godfather. Did not want to famously cast Pacino, so he looked like a little midget. What the hell are we going to put this guy in the movie for? He wanted to get Robert Redford in the movie, but Francis Ford Coppola stuck to his guns and said, no, it's got to be Al. Love story, of course. Love means never having to say you're sorry. Ryan O'Neal, Ally McGraw, Harold and Maude, Great Gatsby, Rosemary's Baby. I mean, acclaimed career. And honestly, the one that I want people to see is the documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture, which was based on Robert Evans' book. You should read the book and watch the documentary, but if you only do one, watch the documentary, because he clearly was a colorful guy, very entertaining. Robert Evans, Joe, a real important figure, I think, in film history, especially if you love movies of the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, looking at this list here, it's just one critically acclaimed movie after another, just his influence on it. And from my understanding, he didn't have any experience before taking over at Paramount in this and just hit after hit with him.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Other news, a stained cigarette-burned cardigan unwashed in nearly three decades has sold at an auction for $334,000. That's right, Nirvana frontman Kurt Cobain. He wore that green button-up during the band's MTV Unplugged performance in 1993. Has not been clean since he last wore it. Killed himself in 1994, age of 27. But according to Darren Julian, president of Julian's Auction, Cobain's mohair cardigan, the holy grail of any article of clothing that he ever wore. Obviously, a really talented musician, highly influential, but $334,000, Joe. This is absurd.
Yeah, I know. It's not even washed. It'd be like, come on, guys, just throw it in the wash if you're going to give it to me first. Probably smells like mid-age spirit at this point, if you know what I mean.
Well, well done. Smells like teen spirit. Louis C.K., if you're a Louis C.K. fan, my cousin is, he's announced a new 14-city international tour in an email to his fans. A rare email updates of subscribers this weekend, beginning his tour Saturday, November 2nd in Richmond, Virginia, concluding January 31st in New Orleans. Along the way, stops will include Tel Aviv, Rome, and Detroit. CK writing on his page, I'm on the road doing professional stand-up comedy, which consists of sharing jokes, stories, observations, lies, non-lines, and being generally ridiculous for the benefit of a laughing audience. He was accused of sexual misconduct by five women in 2017. Allegations which he later said were true, laid low for a brief period before returning to stand-up in August of 2018. Wasn't long before audio leaked of his new material. During an appearance in December, he was heard mocking trans and non-binary individuals, as well as survivors of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Clearly, the guy remains very controversial, and this past May, CK further raised eyebrows with his policy against sharing his material without his consent. I mean, listen, he's obviously a funny guy, clearly got a track record here with what happened to him off the field, so to speak. But I think he's certainly got his fans, Joe, by the fact he's going to be doing a 14-city tour. Maybe he's not doing a Netflix special anytime soon or a TV show. But clearly doing stand-up, maybe that's a safe space that people just enjoy his comedy. Don't judge him. They just focus on the comedy. And whatever he did in the past, they're willing to give him a second chance.
Yeah, I think he has a fan base that will be there. I know a lot of people who won't be there, though. So I think that his apology tour is just going to have to continue for a few years.
Yeah, exactly right. Definitely, some people are definitely holding grudges over his behavior. And lastly, Netflix testing video speed controls for everybody in a hurry to watch everything and then die. That's the headline from AV Club. Reportedly, testing on a feature that will allow some users to control the playback speed of the streaming service's stuff. The goal presumably being to make it easier for someone to watch the entirety of the service's massive library of content and then die. Peaceful in the knowledge they finally got something done in this incomplete, endlessly satisfying world. Seriously. It's bizarre, but TiVo's been giving its users quick mode, which speeds up recorded programs by 30% for years. But now it sounds like the DVR company facing some stiff competition in why is my leisure time moving so slow? Crazy idea here, Joe. I mean, listen, people are listening. Maybe they're listening to this podcast right now at 1.5 speed. I get that. Although Mark Simon has told me I talk way too fast, that I don't allow them to skip ahead. So yeah, nice try, guys, trying to get a little faster through this podcast. But I mean, it's one thing to speed up a podcast, but here with the Netflix Android app, the fact you can actually speed up the show. Isn't that crazy?
Kind of nuts. I, you know, when I first saw this, I thought that I would never use this. But now the more I think about it, there's so many slow scenes in movies or TV shows that I love that I just want to get through. So I will probably use it for that.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. If you're just trying to fly through something, I mean, I guess everyone's just in a hurry, hurry, hurry. But that's the world it is right now. All right, that's our focus when it comes to entertainment news and the new film, The Lighthouse, from Robert Eggers. Now it's time for our special guest.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Not only is he an acclaimed author, but also a teammate here at Cadence 13. It's a real pleasure to bring in James Andrew Miller. He is the best-selling author of many great books, including Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, Those Guys Have All the Fun, Inside the World of ESPN, and Powerhouse, The Untold Story of Hollywood's Creative Artists Agency. I also mentioned the fact he's a teammate. You can check out his Origins podcast as Jim uncovers bold beginnings of success stories in the worlds of television, movies, sports, music, and business. There's been great stuff there in terms of content involving Sex and the City and Curb Your Enthusiasm, ESPN, you name it. It's a real pleasure to welcome in Jim Miller to the podcast. Of course, you can also follow him on Twitter at Jim Miller. As acclaimed as an author he is, he's an even better guy because he's got some time for us to dance in a file. Jim, how are we doing?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about The Irishman, which you and I both saw at the New York Film Festival, and I was so pleased that you enjoyed it as much as I did. I saw that you tweeted out your review, and obviously as somebody who appreciates Pacino and De Niro and organized crime films and Martin Scorsese, what were your thoughts of The Irishman, which will be hitting theaters this Friday?
Well, no offense to the movie itself, but I was lucky enough to get invited to the reception, too, and like nothing like standing there, and then all of a sudden Robert De Niro walks in, and then Al Pacino like follows him like 5 minutes later. It's just crazy. I mean, the idea that Scorsese got these two together. I mean, they've been together, you know, a couple times before, but nothing like this. I mean, I think the movies are a real tour de force. It's somewhere I would put it between Goodfellas and Casino. I'd put it smack right in the middle, only because Goodfellas is, you know, Scorsese wise, like one of my Mount Rushmores, but it's such an unbelievable movie. And one of the things that's really interesting for me, I don't know if you felt this when you were watching it, but Joe Pesci is older now. He's thinner. He's more frail. And I think that his physicality informed a more nuanced and, dare I say, even more emotionally dimensional performance from him. I thought it was, I mean, as great as everybody is in the movie, I thought Pesci was a real, just delicious surprise.
Yeah, I talked to Rebecca Keegan about it, Jim, last week on the podcast. And of course, she does a great job for The Hollywood Reporter. And she also mentioned that, just that his performance was so atypical of what you'd expect in a Scorsese film, that you're used to seeing these firecracker characters in Goodfellas and Casino. And this time, as you mentioned, he's much more thoughtful and measured. And he's somebody who doesn't necessarily take joy in his work, but he's just reasonable about what has to happen. That isn't a word you'd normally expect with Pesci. And as you mentioned, it's been a while since we've seen him. I mean, he's in semi-retirement. So the fact that Marty and Bob were able to coax him into a film again, I agree. He's wonderful in the film and hopefully gets an Oscar nomination.
And if you look at his lines, and if you really, I thought back on it, and I can't wait to watch the movie again, his character and what his character sets in motion. And I mean, obviously the plot is very intricate, but his work in that movie is so important to the plot itself that it's really, you always think that the person who is kind of like the fulcrum and the engine of so much in the plot has to have this, you know, kind of like dominant standing in the movie, particularly from a Scorsese point of view. And yet here's Pesci winding everything up and pushing there all these buttons and stuff. And he does it in a very unusual way for him. I thought it was really, really interesting.
I hope people definitely see it in theaters as well. I know it'll be on Netflix November 27th, but I'm sure Jim can echo my sentiments that this is one of those films you want to see on the grandest, biggest stage possible and really let the film soak over you. Yes, it's long, but it's also engaging the entire time, and it really is telling this guy's life story. It's in many ways a character study. It's a historical piece beyond being a film from one of our great filmmakers. The topic we want to dive into, though, today, Jim, which is a great idea you suggested to me, is about meaningful films for both of us. So it's an interesting topic because so often you look at movies and they give this visceral impact, and there's this emotional attachment that we have to film that maybe feels different when it comes to literature or music or other forms of art. So in the case of film, when there are movies that are impactful to James Andrew Miller and meaningful, what's one that stands out to you? I know we're going to do two or three here, but what's the first one for you?
So I think when we're talking about this and you invited me on the podcast, I think the first thing we said was, we can't say Godfather 1 or Godfather 2 because I was guessing that that would be on your list, and it certainly would be on mine, Godfather 2 first, then Godfather 1. I think, you know, there's a movie that I think a lot of cinemaphiles know, but I don't know if, you know, particularly millennials may know, but it's called The Third Man. It was made in 1949, and for me, I was pretty young when I saw it, and it was one of those things that just stayed with me, and it was so powerful because Orson Welles is in it, actually. But for me, it was about reporting. It was about asking questions of people and finding out a mystery, and it's also about the complexity of friendships. So Orson Welles and Joseph Cotton are friends, and not to give anything away, but basically Joseph Cotton goes to post-war Vienna to meet Orson Welles, and he arrives only to learn that he's dead, that his friend is dead. And the movie is this, that, you know, he kind of goes over, Joseph Cotton examines, trying to find out what happened to his friend. And it just blew me away when I was younger. It's like, wait, you can actually ask people a lot of questions, and you can find out stuff, and then you can understand the complexities of not only friendship, but what happens in a, you know, in a war-torn environment, and people change, and people really become, you know, affected by what's going on around them. So that's my first. What's yours?
I was about to say, there's so much I love, though, about The Third Man. The zither score, the first time you see Welles and you realize he's alive and he gives that cheeky grin on his face, that whole sequence, Graham Greene, as you mentioned, wrote it, that whole sequence of dialogue when they're on the Ferris wheel about, you know, what does democracy give you, the cuckoo clock. And I love, Jim, that final scene. It's one of my favorite scenes because, you know, Holly Martins finally gets the bad guy. And, of course, Welles is doing some horrible, dastardly things. But rather than getting the guy, he does not get the girl. I mean, that beautiful last long shot. Joseph Cotton said he actually thought that Carol Reed was going to cut long before, but instead he's smoking that cigarette and she walks by him. I mean, that's just a heartbreaking scene, isn't it?
It really is. And for people who are listening who haven't seen it, it's just a joy. It's really, really clever. I'm so glad you like it.
Oh, I love it, man. That's such a great film. Raging Bull is the one I'm going to mention just because when I first saw it, I didn't know what to expect, Jim, and I'd heard so much about it, and I knew it's an important film in cinema history, and I said, I don't know if I want to watch this movie, because I felt squeamish about the subject matter, and there's no doubt, if you've never seen it, you know, the character of Jake LaMotta is, in many ways, obviously a monstrous character. He's verbally abusive, he's physically abusive, but as Roger Ebert wrote, it's nothing compared to the blows he delivers in the ring or takes inside the ring as to what happens outside of the ring. But what's so impactful with the movie for me, remember when I saw it as a kid, and maybe I was too young to see it, but I certainly appreciate the level to which Scorsese and De Niro approach the subject matter and were very non-judgmental. And that was my whole thought with this movie, is that in the hands of other filmmakers and other craftsmen, they would be denigrating the character and being very judgmental. But with these guys, they're kind of just showcasing this guy's life, and they're not being, Jim, with any sort of dime store psychology, saying, oh, because his father treated him this way, or his mother did this to him once, and now he became this. This is just who this guy is. They're just presenting it very much like, as you said, you know, in terms of journalism, The Third Man. In this way, they're kind of just saying, journalistically, here's who he is. You can judge whatever you like from him. Here's his flaws. Here's who he is. But we're going to be very honest about him. And what's amazing about the film is, I don't know how these guys did it, but by the end of it, you do feel some sort of empathy for this guy. And you say, after all he's been through and as vicious as he's been, and he deserves all the pain and punishment that he's taken, he does, you know, achieve this rare moment of redemption and clarity. And in that final scene, when you've got De Niro, an actor playing a boxer, Jake LaMotta, giving a speech from Marlon Brando, an actor playing a boxer, Terry Malloy, from On the Waterfront. I mean, it's levels upon levels. But it's for a film which is so tough with such demanding subject matter, it's very poetic, and it's a very beautiful film, which is words you wouldn't expect to use with a film that's been so heavily influential like Raging Bull.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, but I Raging Bull was the movie that helped me understand. I mean, there were probably other examples that I had studied about or knew about, but boy, when it didn't win Best Picture, I think Ordinary People won that year,
yeah,
right? It was 1980. Was it 1980?
Yeah, that's right, 1980.
Right. So, and I was watching. I was, you know, watching the Academy Awards, and Raging Bull was just this unbelievable masterpiece. Ordinary People was a great movie. I mean, thank you, Robert Redford, and Timothy Hutton won, I think, that year, and Elizabeth McGovern was cute, and Mary Tyler Moore, and all that. But Raging Bull was an amazing American movie, and it just was. I think it was one of those things that made me realize that, you know what, I'm going to keep my own counsel in terms of what I think is the best picture of the year, because I can't trust the Academy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The fact it only won a couple of Oscars, one for Best Actor for De Niro and Best Editing for Thelma Schoonmaker, it just seems unfair. Next up for you.
I'm going to go with, we'll keep sports in there. It's kind of an obvious one, but I have to say Hoosiers. Because I mean, it's one of the, you know, if we say that there are only seven stories in the world, it's one of my favorites. And I love this idea of the little engine that could and, you know, combating the odds. I thought it was such a, I mean, there's so many amazing sports movies and everything else. But the thing that I really just loved about Hoosiers was this incredible marriage between character and story. And, you know, Gene Hackman, and with his, you know, difficult background going into this movie, and his character's difficult background, and obviously the odds, and that this little town, and it just, the verisimilitude of it just overwhelmed me. And David Anspaugh, who directed it, I mean, it's amazing that he did. I mean, it was an incredible job he did with that. I thought Barbara Hershey was wonderful. And you just, I don't know, there isn't a time. It's one of those movies where if you're flipping through the, you know, the premium cable channels and it's on, I have to stop, because at any given point, I just think it's so compelling and so raw. And, of course, the ending is just, you know, beyond terrific, even though, you know, we may know it's coming. It's just mind-blowing.
Dennis Hopper is fantastic, too, nominated for an Oscar playing the alcoholic father. Remember, you know, he's a guy who obviously played so many villains in his career, but he was great in the movie.
Probably, I mean, shame on me for not leading with that. One of Dennis Hopper's, you know, most amazing performances, and that's saying a lot. I mean, he was really incredible, and there's a moment where, you know, he's in the hospital, and he's just listening to the game on the radio, and what he does in that scene is just, you know, it's why he was Dennis Hopper. Yeah, I think that's, thank you for mentioning that.
Oh, for sure. And that whole sequence at the end where Hackman, like, I'm sure it's been used so much, Jim, by other sports teams in terms of intimidation and not being overwhelmed by the moment. You know, how high is the net? How long is the gym? Like, that whole speech is wonderful. And as you mentioned, of course, the whole closing.
So smart.
Yeah. So that, when he says, I love you
so
guys, it's tough not to get choked up. My next film, I'm going to mention Taxi Driver, which is a film that I saw in my college years. And I just think it's the best one I've ever seen about urban alienation and loneliness. And this, that character of Travis Bickle, I mean, it's such a great metaphor for, you know, wandering through life, trying to find your place, you know, driving this empty vehicle at night and just observing everything around you. And I just thought that movie, Jim, really tapped into, you know, it's a movie really, you know, when you're young and angry and disenchanted and disenfranchised, and maybe you got dumped by a girl and you can't find the right job and you're so pissed off. And it's just a movie that really spoke to me at that time. And I think it's one of those reasons why it's so resonant, because it really was not only of its time, which is 1976, but a movie now, if you pop in, you say, yep, I can still see how people today would have those types of emotions against people who are unlike themselves. And so they have trouble relating to them, and therefore they're looking for a means of violence to act out, to act upon these impulses, and just that whole idea of saving someone and trying to find salvation. And, you know, Paul Schrader wrote the script. I mean, this is such a beauty from Schrader, because even Quentin Tarantino has said it's the best first-person script he's ever seen. And just, you know, the way that Travis's narration and the impending doom, and the way the movie builds to that stunning climax of violence as Travis decides to take things in his own hands. I mean, this was, as Schrader has said, if I didn't write the script, I would have become this guy. And so I had to get it out of me. And he said he wrote it in 10 days, which is insane. It literally leapt out of him like an animal. And I know, as somebody who's an author who appreciates authenticity and honesty, to me, Taxi Driver is about as honest a piece of filmmaking, particularly from the mind of Paul Schrader.
It doesn't go to any easy places at any given time. I found it. I will say though that I'm glad you emerged from this dark period.
It's true.
whatever, but the truth is that it never lets up. That's the thing. I mean, in some ways, I remember when I saw Taxi Driver, it was exhausting because every moment is just filled with, I mean, it's either dread or apprehension or you're terrified, you're concerned. It's emotionally speaking. I mean, obviously there's a lot going on the screen and there's a story and everything else, but I think one of the things that the script does, and obviously, once again, we're talking about the great De Niro, it's unrelenting. You just don't get a break. I mean, tell me a time in that movie where, you know, you can take a deep breath. I mean, it isn't until the end. It isn't until the credits roll.
Yeah, maybe when Albert Brooks is talking about stool pigeons and he's trying to entertain Betsy, but you're right. Even that comic relief has a sense of unease to it.
Oh, yeah, I guess. But, I mean, you know, even that, because I guess I was thinking, well, they're faking us out because that means something really bad is coming. You know, it's just, exactly. I just thought, I'm not going to fall for this. But yeah, no, Jodie Foster has been amazing in talking about this movie as well. If people want to dig into some of the things that she said about it, it was a powerful moment for everybody involved.
Yeah, the fact that she was 14 years old playing a 12-year-old prostitute, Iris, I mean, her scenes are very impactful because she doesn't seem unhappy, which is just part of what makes Travis so maddening. You know what I mean? He's like, how could you be with this pimp? How could you be okay with this? Like, this is disgusting. This guy's vile. And she's like, you know, sport's fine. He treats me well. He buys me stuff. And like, he just finds it so maddening. It's you're right. There's definitely many levels that it works. Final film for you, Jim, that has been particularly meaningful and impactful for you.
I would say, well, you know, if we do friendship and investigation and we do sports, I'm going to end with something of the heart. And I'm a Natalie Wood freak, so I'm going to say Splinter in the Grass, which was actually Warren Beatty's first movie, made in 1961. And I think the thing that was compelling for me about that movie was the idea that you can have an unbelievably powerful, amazing love in your life, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't mean that it wasn't an incredible relationship. And like that, for me, I saw it when I was a teenager, and I think that kind of made an impact on me. It was, again, we're talking about a movie that was so emotionally raw. William Inge wrote it, and it was just, I mean, it was so important because in so many ways it explores some ground that I had never been exposed to. It's about, you know, things that are in the pre-Depression in the Midwest. I'd never even been to the Midwest, and that world there in the 20s, the roaring 20s, juxtaposed against, you know, what was going to happen with the Depression, and of course the great Ily Kazan. But Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty, are you can't take your eyes off of them in this movie. And I think it's one of the best movies, except for 16 Candles, of course, about young love. I'm kidding, but about young love that I've ever seen. And I think the ending, you know, really had a huge impact on me.
Natalie Wood, just 16 years old, by the way. I mean, I obviously remember her from Rebel Without a Cause, played Maria in West Side Story, but was nominated for her performance in Splendor of the Grass. Amazing to think of where she was in her career. And the expression, Jim, Splendor in the Grass, comes from the romantic poet William Wordsworth. He originally coined that phrase in his poem Ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood. I just think it's a very evocative phrase.
Wow, you've done your homework.
Yeah. Once you gave me a heads up, I said, I got to find something here to Splendor in the Grass. I got
have
one more to
mention. Have you seen the movie?
I have, but I saw it years ago. I couldn't speak to it because I saw it, like, I want to say, like, literally 25 years ago. So I don't remember much about it, except for, as you mentioned, the ending. And I remember thinking that, again, this is about a teenage girl, you know, navigating pain and heartbreak. And I just remember feeling a lot of sympathy for her. Like I said, I don't think, like, that era must have been so hard to try to navigate your own feelings and then trying to balance your own parental obligations or expectations.
Well, the whole engine is, of course, is sexual repression, which we don't get to talk about anymore nowadays. But I think it's an amazing look backward at the role and the power of sexual repression in young people's lives, and how the culture dealt with it as well. And you know, I think that the way that she handles it and the way that she has to navigate it is incredible. And you can also, I mean, let's face it, you can also see in Beatty just what a unbelievable leading man he was going to be. He's pretty powerful in this, and it's a great dynamic with his father, and there's some wonderful contextual things going on about, you know, what was happening in the country, and it's a freaking sad movie, man, but I think there's a lot to be said about lessons of love in it. So that was my third.
Definitely check out Splendor in the Grass if you haven't seen it. My third for me is Do the Right Thing, a microcosm of the world at large, as Spike Lee takes one day back in 1989, the hottest day of the year, to show how all these personalities chime together. And for a movie which is about race and identity and frustration, it's also hysterical. And when you watch Do the Right Thing again, you appreciate the humor of the movie, whether it's Frank Vincent's car getting doused, whether it's just the character bugging out, getting upset that there's no brothers on the wall, the fact that a guy wearing a Celtics jersey steps on his shoes, Sam Jackson's character, Senior Love Daddy. I mean, all of it teams together towards this showdown between Danny Aiello's character, who's brilliant playing Sal. De Niro originally offered the role, turned it down, told Spike it was too reminiscent of too many other characters I've played. Instead, Aiello knocks it to the park as Sal, who is deeply sympathetic, but when he gets driven to the brink by bugging out, utters some racial epithets, and all of a sudden the whole thing falls apart. The pizza parlor is burned down. I mean, it's a heartbreaking movie, but it's also, I think this is important to mention, Jim, because when people think about it, they forget the humor of the movie and the fact that Spike Lee really has a lot of humanity in telling the story about 10 different characters. I mean, from Ozzie Davis to Ruby Dee to John Turturro, every character and every performance is a knockout.
I think it's a very special movie, and I think the one thing that I remember after seeing that movie is how distinctive a vision and a voice Spike Lee has. I think that was the movie for me that is like, wait a second, nobody else could have directed that movie as we saw it. And I thought, wow, this is really special. I mean, obviously he had done things before, and he's done afterwards things after that make you think that, but I was very, very consumed by that thought. And I think that's one of the great things about film, and, you know, the idea that a director, as a writer, I'd like to think that it's all about the writer, but the director in a movie makes so many decisions, including supervising the script. And I think that it just was such a singular kind of movie and so reflective of who Spike Lee is, that even if you had given that same exact script to somebody to direct, it would have been different. It just was, you know, I just thought it was like an X-ray on who this guy is. And I think he's continued to do that even when he made a straight popcorn movie like Inside Man, which I thought was phenomenally successful and so important for him to direct, because it showed that he could do, you know, a real crowd pleaser, but still in his own distinctive way. I think it's a great port of entry into the world of Spike.
Yeah, and it's a great comeback now with Black Klansman, because he's had a lean decade since. But this is a movie, obviously, as you mentioned, not only like Inside Man commercially successful, but he received the critical acclaim and finally got an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. James Andrew Miller, our special guest. You can follow him on Twitter at Jim Miller. When is the next Origins podcast coming out, Jim? I know these take a long time to put together. Is there any timeline we can expect to get some new content?
I think right at the beginning of the year. I think the beginning of the year, and got a couple. In fact, some from the world of movies. So I'm really looking forward to finishing those. I'm working on them today.
Anything on the Larry Sanders Show we can expect from you at any time in the future?
Why do you ask that?
I heard you on Jimmy Trina's podcast, Jim, and you guys were talking about the Larry Sanders Show, and you said what a big fan you were. So I don't know if you have anything coming down the pipeline or just a fan of his, because, God, I love that show.
I'm a big Gary Shandling fan. I am working on something right now, not to be a dick, but I gotta like keep it quiet right now. But yeah, I'm a big Gary Shandling fan, and hope to be doing something with that pretty soon.
Oh, that's great, man, because God, that show and his level of comedy is just brilliant, and I hope people appreciate how good it is. We certainly appreciate James Andrew Miller, as I mentioned, the best-selling author, CAA. Those guys have all the fun. Obviously, the Saturday Night Live book and Origins, new episodes coming in January. This is a great idea, Jim. I really appreciate your generosity, as always, and your time, and some excellent choices. To recap, Jim's choices are really good. Hoosiers, Splendor in the Grass, and I really love The Third Man. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you, man.
Real special get here on Cinephile. Don't know how we got him, but my dad is available. That's right. Papa Burke is in the house. He's here to talk about a documentary which is available on Netflix. It's called Salaam, the First Muslim Nobel Laureate, which is a fantastic documentary which I saw. Zakir Thaver is one of the film's producers. There's a good article here on BBC in case you want to take a look by Abigail Beale that can tell you more about the documentary. But it's currently available, as I mentioned, on Netflix. It's about Pakistani scientist Abdus Salam, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics. And his life's work was key to defining a theory of particle physics. But what's more interesting is the fact that he was a dedicated Muslim, but the very word Muslim was whitened out from his gravestone in Pakistan. So how exactly could somebody who belongs to this faith not be recognized as such? That's where we bring in the scholar, my dad, who can talk more about this. Dad, first and foremost, I know ever since I was a baby, you've always been really obsessed with Dr. Salam and his contributions. What is it about him that's so important to you?
Dr. Abdus Salam was the first Pakistani scientist who won a Nobel Prize. Not only that, he was also an Ahmadi to the sect that I belong to. He brought fame to Pakistan and the whole Muslim world. Since, as Newton was important to the physics in England and Europe, so is Dr. Abdus Salam important to the people of Pakistan and the whole Muslim world in the field of science.
And of course, what's interesting about it is, as you mentioned, even though he's a Muslim, he is not recognized as such because of the Pakistani government, because of their view of Ahmadis, the sect to which we belong. If you can speak further about that and why the documentary explains how he's such a unique person.
Dr. Abdus Salam had four things that his life evolved around. Revolved around. One was his love for Pakistan. The second was the propagation of science in the third world. The third was his love for physics. And the fourth was he wanted to build an institution from where the poor Muslim students or any student, science student who was from third world, he could come and study physics and higher education. So for that reason, he built a international center for theoretical physics in Italy, from where hundreds and thousands of people, students have come and graduated. Not only that, he wanted to build this physics institute in Pakistan, but some short-sighted person who was finance minister then decided not to have it built in Pakistan. At this time, believe it or not, there are thousands of Muslims from students from Pakistan who are coming to Trieste in Italy to study, and they go back and they again teach other students in Pakistan. So they don't have to leave their country the way Dr. Abdus Salam had to leave his country to go to England to study.
So the Pakistani government does not view Ahmadis as Muslims, which is why he felt the need, obviously, to flee and to go further his education elsewhere. So think about that. He loves his own country, yet he is viewed as an outsider there. And as I mentioned, you know, the fact that the word Muslim is even whitened out from his gravestone there. What was your contribution, Dad, to this documentary specifically? Because you are mentioned in the end credits.
It was about 14 years ago that Zakir Thaver, who is the producer of the documentary, he contacted me because I was an Ahmadi and he knew that I had produced some books on Dr. Abdus Salam in Urdu language. He contacted me, and after that, we were in touch with each other for many years. if he had some time, if he had any question, he would ask me and ask for some clarification, which I did. And also, in 1982, Dr. Abdus-Salam came to Madison, Wisconsin to deliver a lecture. And he had informed me through a letter that I will be in Madison at such and such date in July 1982. If you wish to come and see me, you should do. So I went there with my wife and my son Zeeshan, and I met Dr. Abdus-Salam at the Madison University. He was staying in a dormitory. And after he had delivered his lecture, I met him. And we stayed with him for about 2 hours. After that, he told me that he was going to New York. I came back to Toronto, and I arranged with the radio station that they should interview Dr. Abdus-Salam, who had received Nobel Prize 3 years ago. So the radio station, which was called Chin Radio at the time, they interviewed Dr. Abdus-Salam, and they gave me the tape afterwards, which had the interview. So I kept that interview for so long. Later on, I gave that interview to Zakir Thawar, and he has it in the documentary at the very beginning, in about 5 minutes later from the start of the movie. So that's my contribution.
As Zakir himself says here in the article I'm reading for the BBC, the first Muslim to win the prize in science is the very word Muslim whitened out. It's the final affront to the most illustrious son of the soil. He says he and his co-producer, Omar Vandal, only learned about Salam when in the mid-90s they moved from Pakistan to the U.S. to study at university. We read Salam's obituary in the New York Times. Back home, his story had been buried. So it's an excellent documentary, once again, to check out on Netflix, and definitely learn more about somebody who clearly did not receive as much respect and acclaim as he should have back home. Salam, the first Muslim Nobel laureate, once again on Netflix. Dad, any closing thoughts?
I would recommend everybody to watch this documentary. It's a very, very interesting documentary. It shows how a person from a poor background can, with his will and determination, study and make his name for his country all over the world. So I would highly recommend everybody who is interested in science or otherwise, they should watch this documentary.
All right, great work, Dad. Back to your grandkids. All right, thanks so much to my dad. That's right, Papa Virk, Zachariah Virk. You cannot find him on Twitter, but you know what? You can tweet me, @NanasVirk, and I'll let you know what you thought of my dad and him talking about that documentary, Salam, on Netflix. And of course, a big thank you to James Andrew Miller. Jim is always so engaging and fun and thoughtful, and I thought his choices were terrific. Go check out The Lighthouse. Next time on Cinephile, I'll talk about Parasite, the new film from Bong Joon-ho, which is getting tons of rave reviews. And next time, of course, we'll do our Mount Rushmore and The Bada Binge. Until then, on behalf of my producer, Joe, and the entire crew, this is Adnan Burke, and I'll see you at the movies.